So here we want to look at particularly the French Huguenot side of our heritage, of our Christian heritage. The Huguenots have left us a tremendous legacy of heroic faith, Christian endurance, and sacrifice. Their contribution to our culture, our spiritual life, and our prosperity has been out of all proportion to their small numbers. There are many Huguenot surnames amongst us to this day. Blicknort, de Klerk, de Villiers, de Prie, de Toy, Farie, Hugo, Joubert, Roux, Malan, Nell, Pinot, Retief, Rousseau, Taron, Bouillon, Bissaki, and many others. The first Huguenots to arrive at the Cape, well, the very first Huguenot to arrive at the Cape was the 6th of April, 1652. Maria de la Calier, the wife of the first governor of the Cape, Jan van Riebeck. Maria's grandfather had been a French Huguenot pastor that fled to Holland to escape persecution. The Huguenots were Protestants, members of the Reformed Church of France. Their forerunners were the Waldensians, a dynamic Bible study movement which arose in the 12th century, led by Peter Walder, a merchant, a very wealthy merchant of Lyon. The Waldensians desired to study the scriptures and to be faithful to biblical principles in all areas of life. These poor men of Lyon, as they were called, went out in twos and they boldly proclaimed the word of God throughout southern France, northern Italy, and Switzerland. After the Bible was placed on the Index of Forbidden Books by the Council of Valencia in 1229, the Roman papacy began to viciously persecute the Waldensians, and many thousands were murdered. So the Catholic Church banned the Bible in 1229 for non-clergy. Laity could not read the Bible. Do you know when that ban was lifted? When were Roman Catholic laity allowed to read the Bible again for themselves?
Not long ago.
My lifetime. 1962, Second Vatican Council. The survivors of the Huguenots fled to the of the Waldensians fled to the southern Alps of Western Piedmont, and they flourished there. Despite being declared heretics and fearfully persecuted by the Inquisition and the armies of the Pope, the Waldensians grew in number and depth and in dedication of the Lord. Now, when the writings of Dr. Martin Luther came to France, Professor Jacques Lefebvre at Sorbonne University in Paris expounded the epistles of St. Paul and taught the Reformation doctrines of justification by the grace of God alone, received by faith alone. William Farel was one of the students who came to faith in Christ in Sorbonne University. Farel became one of the most prominent leaders in the French Reformation movement, winning whole cities to Christ. William Farel's powerful street preaching was described as full of fire and fury. The Pope is Antichrist, the mass idolatry. His sermons were like cannon blasts. His oratory gripped whole cities. Farel was called the scourge of the priests. Several priests attempted to assassinate Farel. After one attempt at his life failed, Farel whirled around and declared to the priest that fired the bullet, "I'm not afraid of your shots." With great evangelistic zeal and skill in debating, Farel succeeded in winning most of the French-speaking Switzerland to the Protestant faith. And amongst these cities were Neuchâtel and Geneva. In 1535, William Farel arrived in Geneva declaring, "I have been baptized in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. I go about preaching Christ, how he died for our sins and rose again for our justification. Whoever believes in him will be saved. Unbelievers will be lost. I am bound to preach to all who will hear. I'm ready to dispute with you, argue, debate." And that was his style. He would go into a city, preach the gospel, until the armies of the bishop came to shut him down. Then he'd challenge the bishop to a debate. The people thought this was a great idea, and he'd always win the debates. And you can even go and see in Neuchâtel the fountain where the bishop tried to drown Farel, and Farel whirled round and punched the bishop's lights out, and with blood streaming from his knuckles, he went into the pulpit and started to preach to people while his friends Pierre Ferret and Fremont kept the doors shut against the bishop's people, and at the end would call the people to decide, are you going to choose for Reformation, biblical truth, or are you going to stay with papal corruption and superstition? And people choose for Reformation, and he won cities to Christ. And this is a picture depicting the 21st of May, 1536, when the General Assembly of Citizens in Geneva voted in favor of the Reformation and made the Protestant faith the official religion of the city. Not that they fully understood all the implications, but they were more rebelling against the papacy and the corrupt bishop than understanding the Reformation. But Farrell is a good evangelist, but a man's got to know his limitations. And it was at this decisive point that 27-year-old French reformer John Calvin was forced by local war to detour through Geneva. He only meant to spend a single night in Geneva. However, Farrell heard of this famous scholar, the author of the Institutes, and he rushed over to recruit him, but Calvin was not interested. And the more Farrell explained his plans and described the situation in Geneva, the less John Calvin felt inclined to stay. He realized that to accept Farrell's challenge would involve him in controversies and conflict. But his timid, shy nature shrank from such unscholarly activities. Calvin's mind was set on a lifetime of study. He wanted to be a professional student. But Farrell insisted he must stay and help to disciple Geneva. Farrell knew his limitations. He was able to debate and persuade and evangelize, but he needed a scholar to disciple this distracted city. Farrell rose up in his chair and he thundered, "May God curse your studies if now in a time of need you refuse to lend aid to Christ's church." And John Calvin was visibly shaken, and he recalled later he was struck with terror. In Farrell's voice, he had heard the call of God. Now, this is the Reformation Monument in Geneva. You can see John Calvin's the most prominent stepping forward, a bit taller than the others, with both hands on the Bible. Next to him is Beza, the great Theodore Beza of the Academy, and he's got the Bible in his right hand. Similarly, you can see that John Knox of Scotland, he's got the Bible in his right hand. Farrell's the only one who's got the Bible in his left hand, and notice he's got his finger in a place, holding a place like he's ready to be, and his right hand's in a fist. Everything is significant in this monument. Farrell was a fighter. He was a bold debater. He is aggressive, kick the door down, bash the bishop if need be, take his pulpit by force, win the city to Christ by all means. He was aggressive. There and then, Calvin yielded and consented to serve in Geneva. Geneva then became the hub of the French Reformation. What Wittenberg had been in the first generation of reformers, Geneva became to the second generation of reformers. Its printers became the busiest in Europe. What Wittenberg printers had experienced under Luther, now the Geneva printers experienced under Calvin. In fact, the greatest printing industry in the world at that time, and the greatest amount of freedom of speech, freedom of the press, was experienced in Geneva under Calvin. A stream of Reformation books poured out, and thousands of pastors, evangelists, and missionaries were trained in Geneva's academy under Calvin and sent throughout Europe. In fact, here you can see in Calvin's auditoire, where we held our Calvin 500 celebrations back in 2009, on the 500th anniversary of the birth of John Calvin. This is where he had his students, who came from all over the world, including many from Scotland and England. And, of course, they took the Reformation back there too. Here, you can see a contemporary picture, the oldest contemporary picture of a Calvinist church. And, amongst other things, you can see that people are sitting all around, the dogs in the church, quite happily. And this is the first time pews were ever seen in the church. If you've seen the Luther film, the recent one, totally anachronistically, has everyone sitting in pews. And a men and women sitting together, no less. But there were no pews before the Calvinists. The Lutherans didn't even have pews yet. The pews came in from the Calvinist Reformation because of the need for people to sit and take notes and open their Bibles and read along. Because you're coming not to watch the Mass or to take part in the Mass. You're coming to hear the Word of God and to have your mind renewed. And so this just gives you an idea of a Calvinist church at the time. Under John Calvin, over 2,000 Reformed churches were established in France alone. And his missionaries went all over. This is interesting because when I was converted, I was told that Calvin was against evangelism and that people who become Calvinists stop being evangelists. Well, John Calvin obviously didn't know anything about that. He is sending evangelists and missionaries everywhere. As King Francis died in 1547, France fell under the control of his wicked witch of a wife, Jezebel-type Catherine de Medici. And this Jezebel of manipulative queen of intrigue dominated French politics for the next decade. And her sons and sons-in-laws and so on caused havoc to the Reformation. The regency by law should have passed to Antonio de Bourbon, the leader of the Huguenots, but he is Protestant. So although he is next in line for the throne, Catherine de Medici assumed the regency herself, and as an ardent Catholic, Catherine determined to rid France of the contagious disease of Protestantism. On Sunday, the 1st of March, 1562, the Duke of Guise supervised the massacre of hundreds of Protestants in a church in Vassy. And this is one of the pictures to depict that horror as Christians were murdered in their church on Sunday. To avert war, the heir to the throne, Henry, King of Navarre, son of Antonio de Bourbon, was arranged to marry Catherine's daughter, Marguerite. Now, it just so happened that Farel and Pierre Ferret had preached the gospel to the Queen of Navarre, who is the mother of King Henry, who should have been the next King of France, and she was a dedicated Christian. Even though she is the sister of Francis, who was persecuting the church, there was his sister praying with Pierre Ferret and with Farel and organizing evangelistic outreaches from the throne and castle of Navarre. So here you can see the religious conflict for the soul of France is epitomized in this one family. So this wedding between a Huguenot, Henry, and a Catholic was meant to herald peace in France. But it turned out to be a trap. As Protestant aristocracy poured into Paris for this historic wedding, Catherine de Medici had convinced her teenage son, King Charles IX, to order a treacherous wholesale massacre. Beginning early in the morning of 24th of August, 1572, Henry of Guise mobilized Catholic forces to fulfill the king's command. Kill them all, kill them all. In Paris alone, over 5,000 Protestants were massacred. The death toll exceeded 30,000 throughout the countryside. The Spanish ambassador reported jubilantly to Rome, "As I write, they're killing them all, sparing not even the children. Blessed be God." Can you imagine anyone reporting something like that? And these are some of the pictures you'll see at the Huguenot Museum depicting the atrocities, the massacres of Protestants throughout the country as part of a Catholic conspiracy to decapitate the Protestant leadership. At this time, although Protestants were only 10% of France, Protestants were 80% of the nobles of France. And therefore, the top leadership was leading France inexorably towards becoming a Protestant country. France could have become Protestant, but for St. Bartholomew's Eve. Treachery of a high order. By the way, I don't know if you've used G.A. Henty books as readers, but they're great dramatic books which always teach history. They're always set in a historic sense, and G.A. Henty, real adventurer himself, produced some great novels and very insightful. These are some of the etchings and woodcuts that you've got in his books. The English embassy looking out the window in shock at what was going on. They had a few people come to them for refuge. Here's Catherine de Medici depicted coming out to examine the dirty day's work of 24 August 1572. Pope Gregory XIII and his cardinals in Rome rejoiced at the news and attended a solemn high mass of thanksgiving. And the Pope ordered a special medal to be struck commemorating the massacre. And here you can see an angel of death holding a cross and a sword with a sword in hand with a whole lot of dead Protestants there. And the Pope saying the Pope approves the killing of Coligny, Gaspar de Coligny, the head of the Huguenots, Admiral de Coligny. And he commissioned frescoes to decorate the Vatican celebrating these massacres. Sort of like the dictator of Haiti having a necklace murder oil painting behind his presidential desk. The St. Bartholomew's Day massacre permanently altered Protestant thinking. Calvinists now turned from previously accepting the divine right of kings to advocating separation of powers, limited government, and the rule of law. The Catholic cause, already stained by Bloody Mary's persecutions in England and the Duke of Alva's slaughter in the Netherlands, was now indelibly identified with the most bestial persecutions, tyranny, and treachery. St. Bartholomew's Day massacre began the eight wars of religion in France, very significant to our history, as you'll see just now. Here you can see the green areas represent where the Huguenots were the majority, including famously La Rochelle. La Rochelle was, of course, heavily sieged. The greenish areas, the off-green, represent those who are loyal to the king, whoever the king is, and M.D. Brown, the Catholic League, those who loyal to the papacy no matter what. And this led to civil war, which trained the ancestors of the Huguenots, who, of course, settled South Africa. Henry of Guise was murdered on orders of King Henry III, who then was himself assassinated, leaving the Protestant heir, Henry of Navarre, as the only serious contender for the throne of France. This is the War of the Three Henrys, basically, two Catholic, one Protestant. Now, because the Catholic majority of France would not tolerate a Protestant king, Henry declared himself a Catholic with the famous words, "Paris is worth a mass." Now, was he a sellout? Was he a traitor? Was he an apostate? Or was he actually doing what he needed to do to bring an end to the wars of religion and the persecution of Protestants? In 1594, Henry entered Paris in triumph as King Henry IV. And in 1598, he signed the Edict of Nantes, which guaranteed the freedom of religion for Huguenots. And so, this is on display at the Huguenot Monument in Frontchamp II. He made freedom of religion a policy. For the next 12 years, the Huguenots prospered, and so did the whole of France. But then in 1610, Henry IV was murdered by a Jesuit, and under the Catholic Louis XIII and his chief minister, Cardinal Richelieu, the Protestant Huguenots were placed under increasingly more severe pressure. Now, it's at this point that the Three Musketeers and the Four Musketeers enter, and mostly our children have been taught to think the Musketeers are the heroes. But the Musketeers were the Catholics persecuting the Protestants and murdering the Protestants. So we've allowed a Catholic author to get Protestants to be rooting for anti-Christian persecutors of the Church. The Musketeers were working for Louis XIII, Louis XIV, and Cardinal Richelieu. These are ultra, ultra anti-Christian pagan persecutors. During this time, the Huguenots became known as the Church of the Wilderness, as services need to be conducted in secrecy, frequently in the forest. Notice this fold-up pulpit that could be carried on the arm and set up in the forest. You can see these pictures and more at Frontchamp and the Huguenot Monument and Museum. The Huguenots became famous throughout the whole Protestant world for their heroic suffering, unshakable faith, and steadfast courage. Then in 1685, Louis XIV, the Sun King, revoked the Edict of Nantes with the Edict of Fontainebleau. And it's interesting because we've got films like Man in the Iron Mask and so on, which make out Louis XIV, the Sun King, to be a wonderful, tremendous, great king. He wasn't. He was the worst persecutor of the Church that France ever had. And he had Christians rowing boats like Ben-Hur type things as galley slaves. And he had churches destroyed, like this magnificent Huguenot church, pulled down. The revocation forbade Protestant church services, required the education of all children as Catholic, and prohibited emigration and all kinds of tortures, Inquisition-like, for Protestants. They came into people's homes, persecuted them, forced them at the barrel of a gun to sign revocations of their faith. And so many people just lost their homes. If you were a Protestant and you wouldn't revoke your faith and embrace Catholicism, they literally would take over your home, kick the people off, land expropriation without compensation. Many hundreds of thousands of French Huguenots, which included most of the intellectuals were Huguenots, most of the doctors and professional people were Huguenots. So this was a catastrophic disaster for France. By the way, the word refugee is a French word. First originated, applied to the Huguenots at this time, 1685. And so that when you use the word refugee, it should evoke in one's mind the Huguenots of France, the revocation of Edict of Nantes, Sun King, Louis XIV, persecution of Protestants. Hundreds of thousands of people left their homes, their farms, everything, and fled. They immigrated to North America, particularly New York and Virginia. And by the way, this is the background to, if you've seen the film The Patriot, which they edited out this fact that why was the Marsh Fox, who is French, so anti-French? His parents were Huguenots and his grandfather be murdered by the Catholics. But because Mel Gibson's a Catholic himself, he would not allow that to be in the film. So they left out why he was anti-French, because he was Protestant, he was descendant of the Huguenots, and the French had been persecuting his family and murdered his grandparents. And that was just edited out of the story, because the Marsh Fox is based on an actual character. They call him the Ghost in the Patriot film, but the Huguenots were part of France, and by the way, the Spaniards landed in Florida and massacred a settlement of Huguenots, as just showing you the kind of vindictiveness that was continuing against the Huguenots much later. Many fled to England, to Germany, where they were warmly welcomed by Prince Frederick, Kaiser Frederick, Wilhelm, and in fact, they ultimately even became Huguenots, ended up entering the royal family of England, Prince William and Mary, who became King William and Queen Mary of England, Glorious Revolution, 1688. That was a Huguenot king who had married to a Stuart princess. And so they fled, including to Cape of Good Hope. There we are. We only got a few hundred, but they made a big impact. And so the Huguenots fled France, and this basically gutted the heart and soul out of France. And it made France receptive to the French Revolution later. And so the grandchildren of those who had persecuted the Protestants were marched off to the guillotines under the French Revolution. Everything has consequences. And so you can see the Huguenot colony, the first of the Huguenots start to arrive here, 1688. Here from a picture we've got in a hallway from the Reformation Museum, a hallway you can see this, which I picked up in Geneva. The pink or red areas represents where the Lutherans were majority. The green, where the Calvinists or the Reformed side were. And the yellow has kind of faded in this picture here, but England also had the Anglican. But the Puritans who came to England were trained in Zurich and Geneva. The Puritans were Swiss-trained Reformed people who made an impact on England. And that's why the Geneva Bible was the greatest Bible in England at the time of the Reformation. And that, of course, was done in Calvin's Auditoire, under partly John Knox's oversight. This is an interesting map, because the green shows where the Protestants were the majority, the brown shows where the Catholics were the majority, and the yellow shows areas that did become Protestant with the later lost to the Counter-Reformation. And most of Czechoslovakia, Hungary, even parts of Austria and Belgium were Protestant and were lost due to Catholic massacres. In Belgium, they slaughtered so much of the population, more than half of the population of Belgium fled. The only other time in history, other than Zimbabwe, that I know of, where more than half of the total population has fled. That happened in Belgium, which used to be part of the Netherlands. When you go to Netherlands today, you'll find there's a bit of a similarity between Afrikaans and Netherlands. But if you go to Belgium, amongst the Flemish, you find the Afrikaans and Flemish is very close. In fact, I could understand them very well, and I was surprised. Now, what you've got to remember is, in 1652, when the Dutch started to settle the Cape, Belgium was part of the Netherlands. Belgium only became a separate country in 1830. So there was a time when what today is Belgium was Netherlands and was mostly Calvinist. And I think that must be one of the reasons why so many of our, so much of our Afrikaans language is compatible with Flemish, because they would have been more from the Flamps people, as they would say. In fact, is Afrikaans not similar to Flamps? Yeah, you're speaking Flamps. Flamps Afrikaans? Africa Flamps? Africa Flamps Afrikaans? Possible. So, hundreds of those who moved to Holland sailed for the Cape of Good Hope, where they settled in and around what was then a wilderness called Olifantshoek. This was later renamed Franschhoek. Now, when we say settled, let me make it clear, they were given nothing. The Dutch East India Company was actually very stingy. They sold them this worthless, barren area of thorn bushes. And they had to pay for generations. And it was absolutely unsettled, worthless land, where it was called Olifantshoek because elephants lived there, and rhinos and hippos and crocodiles and everything else. It was not a habitable place. And they had to pay for the very spades and picks and shovels they were given. And they were charged top dollar because Dutch East India Company had complete monopoly. So when people speak about, you know, we want to take back the land that was stolen from us, well, first of all, nobody was living in Olifantshoek and never had. Just as one example. And this land, how can you take land without compensation? This land is no longer the barren, worthless wilderness of thorn bushes. This has been turned into by a lot of hard work. These vineyards didn't come by accident. There's been a lot of investment in it. Land isn't just land. There's buildings. There's wells. There's all sorts of things. And you can see the Cape Dutch influence and how they made the wilderness blossom. Absolutely extraordinary. This does not look like it did when they arrived there over 300 years ago, mind you. Now, Gaspar de Coligny was the first victim of the St. Bartholomew's Damascus. He's the admiral, the highest ranking leader of the Huguenots, the leader of the Huguenots in France, and he died in the St. Bartholomew's Damascus, 1572. But his daughter, Louise de Coligny, married Prince William of Orange, the father of Dutch liberties, William the Silent, he's often called, the man who led the resistance against the Spanish Catholics. And Prince William of Orange, William the Silent, was actually brought up in the court of the very Charles V, who Luther defied, my conscience kept to the word of God. And he was brought up Catholic, but he converted to Christ and became a dedicated Protestant. The marriage between Huguenot aristocracy and Dutch royalty resulted in William III of Orange, later becoming King of England and hero of the Protestant forces in Northern Ireland, like the Battle of the Boyne. They still celebrate in the Protestant Ireland every year. So this was the Glorious Revolution of 1688 and the English Declaration of Rights of 1689. To this day, orange is the colour of the Protestants in Northern Ireland, and it was chosen as the name of one of the largest rivers in South Africa, the Orange River. Doesn't look orange, but it's named after the Prince of Orange. And Orange Free State was named after the Prince of Orange. And that's why I don't call it the Free State, I call it the Orange Free State, which is what it was called from the beginning. The orange in the old South African flag, the Ranje Blanje Blo, also reflected this appreciation of the great role played by the Huguenots in the fight for faith and freedom in Holland, Britain, and in South Africa. And orange is still the colour of the Protestants in Northern Ireland. And it's a precious colour to us too. And as Kieran was talking about, our flag's got the history of the British colonies of Natal and of the Cape, the Orange Free State, and the Transvaal, the Vierkleur, which is the old Dutch flag with the green parallel, green vertical stripe added to the parallel of the Dutch flag. Of course, you've also got the French colours in the Dutch flag, except that the French would have the vertical tricolour, as this is the parallel tricolour. And that was our flag flying over the castle. The persecution on the Protestants in France was formally brought to an end by the Edict of Toleration signed by King Louis XVI in 1787. This is the poor king who suffered the French Revolution and was beheaded. The Edict of Toleration didn't last very long, but it was a good gesture. In October 1985, to commemorate the tricentenary of the revocation of the Edict of Nantes by Louis XVI, President François Mitterrand of France announced a formal apology to the descendants of the Huguenots all around the world. It took 300 years, but it's nice to get a bit of vindication and recognition history. The French government at that time released a special postage stamp in honour which reads, France is the home of the Huguenots. And many of the children outside are drawing this and getting the meaning. The four-part Maltese cross symbolises the four Gospels. But notice they've got 2 points on each, so that there's 8 points at the top which come to the 8 Beatitudes. But if you take the fleur de lilies, representing the nobility between them, you add that together, you get 12 for the 12 apostles. The dove under that is the church under the cross of Christ. Now you notice that the fleur de lilies between the four parts of the cross form a heart. And it was inspired by someone who witnessed the burning of two couples who were about to get married, but Protestants, Huguenots. And as a result, they were condemned to be burned at the stake. And they were put in four stakes facing one another so that they would have to see their beloved die as they were dying. I mean, torture. What kind of people think up such things? And so the Huguenot emblem was drawn up with this in mind, of also bringing up the four loves facing one another on their wedding day, executed by burning. And interesting, that is the symbol of the Huguenots. Such a story. If you've never had the opportunity to visit the Huguenot Monument and Museum in Frontruck, you'll find a fascinating and inspiring experience. There are booklets on the family trees and descendants of each of the Huguenot families, which can be purchased from the museum, and one can go and see where families chose which farm. And it's a beautiful place, this monument to the Trinity, the Triune God, with the sunburst and the cross of Christ above. We've had our guests, Uruguay, come from Europe. Every Reformation Day, 31 October, we have Reformation celebration service at the Huguenot Monument as the closest Reformation monument and museum to Cape Town, less than an hour's drive. And we often will have the day before a conference in the Frontruck beautiful chapel. What a lovely, lovely chapel, which has got such amazing wood panelings, beautifully set up. And so we've run everything from concerts with the Uruguay in this lovely little church. Notice how these churches, they start rectangular and then they're built out on both sides wings. And that was after 1860, the 1860 revival and days of Andrew Murray. And then they had to build the upper galleries too, because they had to accommodate all the people who got converted during the revivals. So when we've had the Uruguay down here, we've gone to the waterfront and taken over the stadium there, the amphitheatre, in order to have evangelistic outreach. And wonderful to see the people walking past, joining and singing Amazing Grace. And so on. Just people from all kinds of walks of life and lots of tourists coming past. So as Proverbs says, that wisdom cries aloud at the gateways of the city and at the crossroads. And that's what we need to do. We need to be going out and evangelizing and claiming these places back for Christ. And that's what the Reformation is all about. Reverend Erle Stegen, Pastor Bunce Mission founder, speaking at the waterfront as well. As soon as he did, he started to have security coming to, we've got to stop this. He's mentioning Jesus. And some Jewish lady complained, and we've got to close this down. I said, do you want to write? Have you heard these people singing Amazing Grace? I said, the people love this. You know, it's amazing. You can have rock groups over there, no problem. But the moment a person stands up and honors Christ, there's going to be somebody who complains. But nevertheless, praise the Lord for Uruguay and what they were able to do. And our prayer when we look at the Reformation is, will you not revive us again that your people may rejoice in you? I've written reports in Jeugdtijdschrift over the years on different aspects of the Huguenots and our Reformation heritage. Everything I've been sharing is in our Sketches from South African History book, and we've got a whole lot of history books here, including Kearns, Balula, Stephen Mitford Goodson's books, and Smuts, for example. We're trying to put on our reformationsa.org website lots of PowerPoints, emails, webs, articles. If you want to be on our Reformation Society mailing list, we've got the sign-up boards over there. On our website, we put many different historical articles, also audios. But what I'd like to also show you, just to give you a bit of a snapshot of history, we all should know about Lady Anne Barnard. And her watercolors and sketches are absolutely invaluable because, you know, men don't actually notice a lot of things. And without Lady Anne Barnard's books and sketches, we wouldn't even know what color the walls were of the castle originally or anything like that. But she was her husband was a colonial secretary when England first occupied the Cape. So she came here in 1796, and she traveled all over these areas. And her descriptions are the best descriptions we have of what the Cape was like 200 years ago. And amongst the things that she tells us is that the English built a road from Cape Town to Stellenbosch, which was gone in 1 year. Sea sand wiped it out. And that's why the English started to plant thousands and tens of thousands of trees. And they forested the Cape to enable their roads to work so that they weren't washed away by sea sand across the Cape Flats. Now, you've got people today who are saying, these trees aren't indigenous and so on. Well, no, but neither are we. So if they want to get rid of all these trees, which they're doing, we could go back to a situation where the Cape couldn't accommodate more than about 10,000 people or so. If you want a few million people to live in the Cape, you need to have trees. Originally, the Cape didn't have much trees. Now, look here. For example, you can see there's some, the settlers have planted some trees. There's obviously plantations, but generally not much trees. And here in Lady Anne's Chronicle of the Cape, you get a bit of a feel. No, there's no trees on the hillside there. very little trees on the slope to the mountain. This is from the castle. You can see this Cape Town from the castle walls. No trees on Lion's Head and so on at that stage. But the British were to rectify that. They planted trees like there was no tomorrow. They went on a tree planting binge. And you can see that in the lifetime of Lady Anne Barnard, she documents what was going on, and her watercolors give us the idea of what was going on. In fact, when they decided to restore the Cape Castle, and they went to her to discover, oh, this is the color, this was painted, you know, green for these window frames and red for those window frames. Do you know the difference between whether you've got a window frame in green or red at the castle? Red is where there's powder and shot and ammunition stored. Green is normal. If you go in Newlands Forest, you'll see this, reminding us about paradise, which was Lady Anne Barnard's cottage up in, it's now ruins, but up in Newlands Forest. Again, see how there was very few trees then, but boy, did the British plant trees on Devil's Peak. And there's a lot of things you can live with. This is where she would have been catering. She acted as first lady of the Cape because the governor's wife was not interested in coming to the Cape. So she's the second most, married the second most important person in the British administration here. So she became the hostess for the big parties. I don't know if you've counted how many chairs are in the castle main banquet hall. 104. And have any of you been to Newlands, to the Newlands Hotel? Not Newlands. Yes. Newlands Hotel. This was another cottage that she built initially under her direction. And that's the Newlands... Sorry, the Vineyard Hotel. The Vineyard Hotel in Newlands. That's right. That's correct. So this is, again, Lady Anne Barnard's original designs. And she really put her stamp on the Cape. And again, I think when people are talking about the drought today, drought was the normal state of the Cape before the British started planting tens and hundreds of thousands of trees. And that changed the ecosystem. Just like when gold was discovered on the Witwatersrand, there's very few trees there. But the vast amount of trees planted in and around the gold fields and the suburbs changed the whole ecosystem, that now you get a lot more rain in the Transvaal, Witwatersrand area than you had before. These are just facts. Deforestation causes drought. Reforestation brings greater rainfall. And there's a lot of good reasons for this. It's, if there's any rain around here, you'll notice forest growing. She documented there was only forest at Hout Bay, that's what's called Hout Bay, Wood Bay, and Knysna. Between Hout Bay and Knysna, there was no forest in the Cape. I remember driving from Cape Town past the airport, all the way up Solaris Pass, past Rabaul, all the way down to almost Hermanus, through forest on both sides. You couldn't see most of what, you couldn't even see most of the mountain because you had forest both sides. The destruction of the forests in the last 24 years in this city has been absolutely catastrophic. And we shouldn't be asking why are we having less rain than we used to get before. I mean, that's obvious. We've been reverting back to what the Cape was before the forestation took place 200 years ago, which totally changed the ecosystem and enabled us to accommodate more people here. So if you go the way that these radicals want, to get rid of all the trees that aren't indigenous and not to plant anything else in their place, what you're going to have is a city that can't accommodate the millions of people living here. Cape Town will become a ghost town and people will have to go somewhere else. So, just a few interesting things from Lady Anne Barnard. Her diaries are absolutely priceless. Any questions or comments?
Why would it become a ghost town? What do people get?
You get rid of the trees, you lower the rain. At the moment, we've got restrictions. If we don't do more reforestation, they keep bringing more people into the Cape. You'll either have to bring the population down or reduce people's use of water to something even more ridiculous than 50 litres per person per day. And yes, Cape Town cannot sustain 4 million people. What is it now? 4.5 million people in the Greater Cape area. They had trouble providing enough water for them when there were 10, 15,000 over 200 years ago. If they want to get rid of all the trees that were planted by the colonials, then they'll have to get rid of all the people who've been added because we increased our rainfall. Deforestation causes drought. Reforestation brings more rainfall. I mean, how easy is that?
Yes.
And you say Geneva became the like the headquarter for the so
pressing industry.
After you said the it became big, the Reformation, and then they killed all the people on that wedding, and then
yes.
What happened to Geneva? Did it like go back?
No, but Geneva's in Switzerland. Oh. Geneva's not affected by the Huguenot massacres. Geneva's in Switzerland. We're talking about Paris and France, which is the near neighbor. So this is why so many of the Huguenots fled all over the world, including to here. And that's actually the backstory to even the Patriot film, although that's only a little bit true. There's a lot of fake in that too. But yes, so France could have become a Protestant country. For that matter, England could have become a Catholic country if the Spanish Armada had succeeded. Yes.
When you say deforestation causes drought,
yes.
How does that work? Because like the sun evaporates water from the sea, not the land.
Correct.
So depending, it doesn't really matter what's on the land, it's still going to rain on the land.
No, not at all. Most rain in the world falls over the oceans. To bring the rain clouds from the oceans inland, you need pumps, so to speak. It is the forests that create the low pressure that pull in the rain. So the forests are the lungs, but basically the forests are what pull in the clouds that would have been just dropping the water over the sea and brings it inland. And the deeper the forests go, the further inland goes. That's why you'll find where we've got forests in the Cape, we have a good rainfall. Where we don't have forests in the Cape, you don't get much rainfall. You get no shortage of rain falling over the ocean. But that's not going to help us. We can't drink salt water. We need fresh water, and that's only going to come from what grows here. So, for example, if you take just the Amazon jungle, you know the Amazon's a great river. On any given day, there's more millions of liters and gallons of water in the clouds above the Amazon than there are in the water. On any given day in South Africa, there's more tons of water in the clouds over the country than there are in the Orange River, the Vaal River, and all the other rivers you want to give. The trouble is, how can we get that rain to fall over the land? It's the forests that will bring in the rainfall and the clouds. So it's like a pump. And it's absolutely, if you can think of the clouds as rivers in the sky, but it's no good passing us by and dropping out there in the Atlantic. We want it here. It's the forest that welcomes it in. And you can see it in Cape Town. You climb the top of Table Mountain. What do you see? Close to the mountain, green, 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 super green, mega green. You look out towards Cape Flats, where there's next to no trees, brown, dry. And it's so often. Often it's pouring with rain here in Rondebosch and Newlands, and nothing's even falling at Pinelands or further away. So, sorry?
Also, relief rain plays a part in that too, from the mountains.
Oh, yes. The mountains and forests, great combination. Mm. Spectacularly good combination. That's why our first dams are built on top of Tate Mountain. But you go up there, there's no shortage of, those dams are overflowing. That's the first place to get the rain, if we get rain anyway. So the forest. So planting trees makes sense. Chopping down trees is bad. Now, I was taught this at school in Rhodesia. I remember 1972, they had a campaign. We are going to plant 5 million trees in Rhodesia because there's 5 million inhabitants. And that year, they planted 5 million trees. I come down to Pinelands in 1977, and they had a campaign. We've got to forest the canal. And people are sponsoring and schools and families, and they're planting trees all over the canal. Now, 70s was the time when trees are good. Suddenly in the 90s and so on, it's, trees are bad. They're alien trees. They've got to chop them all down. If they replaced them with some indigenous trees, it would be very different. But they didn't. So we've lost Celia Forest. We've lost Constantia Neck Forest. We've lost so many forests. And I'm not surprised we're in trouble. But they keep chopping down more trees. All of us should be major tree-hugging, planting trees type people. Yes.
Basically, what you need to do is just fill your garden with the biggest trees you
can
find and then you can...
Well, it would help. And, of course, there's power... Okay, so, for example, they will tell you a tree takes away... a tree sucks up water. In fact, a big tree can suck up 1,000 litres in a day. But they can attract that much... They release water vapour, and that water vapour comes back as rain. So, yes, they use a lot of rain, but it's recycled. It's brought back. So the idea that we've got to chop down trees because the trees use water. Yes, but they're provided too.
Is there a place where you can like find a deep meaning of the cross of the hearts and the?
Oh, you're talking about in the Huguenot. Yes, Huguenot Monument, Huguenot Museum, the Huguenot books. We've got. I presume it would be on the website. I know that Emma outside, who's had children working on the Huguenot crosses in particular, she's got all that there too. We've got more details. At the Huguenot Monument, they've actually got on the wall paintings with the full explanation in the reception area in front of it. Yes?
Is the Maltese cross not like it originates from the Freemasons and that there's some sort of connection? Why?
No, it doesn't originate with them. It predates them. The reason why we're confused with it is because the Knights of Malta used the Maltese cross, and the Freemasons later acquired control over parts of them, and so there's a Knights of Malta connection, but the Maltese cross has been around hundreds of years before the Freemasons even were thought of. Yes.